the seer. Jump back a couple of decades, and the solution to my dilemma would have been obvious. It was a commonly held belief, and still is by many home cooks and professional chefs alike, that in order to help a roast, steak, or chop retain moisture, you should first sear it, creating a crust that will lock in the juices. Now, anyone who has read their Harold McGee, or has ever seen juices squeeze out through the seared side of a steak after you flip it over on the grill, knows that this can't possibly be completely true. But what about partially true? Could a sear actually help retain at least some of the juices? In order to test this, I cooked two roasts cut from the same rib sections with comparable surface areas, weights, and fat contents according to the following processes. Roast 1. Seared in a pan in 3 tablespoons canola oil over high heat on the stovetop until a well-browned crust formed, about 15 minutes, then transferred to a 300-degree Fahrenheit oven and roasted to an internal temperature of 120 degrees Fahrenheit, removed, and rested for 20 minutes, during which time the temperature in the center rose to 125 degrees Fahrenheit and then dropped back down to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Roast 2. Roasted in a 300-degree Fahrenheit oven to an internal temperature of 120 degrees Fahrenheit, removed, and seared in a pan in 3 tablespoons canola oil over high heat on the stovetop until a well-browned crust formed, about 8 minutes, then rested for 20 minutes, during which time the center temperature rose to 125 degrees Fahrenheit and then dropped back down to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. If searing does, in fact, lock in juices, we would expect that the steak that was first seared and then roasted would retain more juices than the steak that was roasted and then seared. Unfortunately, for old wives' tales, the exact opposite was the case. I carefully weighed each roast at each step of the process to gauge the amount of moisture and fat lost during the cooking. These are the results. The meat that was seared first and then roasted lost 1.68% more juices than the one that was roasted and then seared. It's not a huge difference, but the knowledge that searing conclusively does not lock in juices was liberating in the ways that it allowed me to think about the recipe. Score: Commandment 1. Perfect crust? Check. Commandment 2. No gray zone? Negative. Commandment 3. Full-on juiciness? Check. Inside and out. So great, you may be thinking. You can sear first, or you can sear afterward, and it makes no difference. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal, as some of the more astute listeners may have noticed the timing before, is that if you start with a raw roast, it takes around 15 minutes in the hot pan to get a well-browned crust, during which time the outer layers of the roast are busy heating up and overcooking, just like they did when roasted in a 400-degree Fahrenheit oven. But to get a well-browned crust after the prime rib has been roasted, you need only around 8 minutes in the pan. Why is this? It all has to do with water. In order for the surface of a roast to reach temperatures above the boiling point of water, 212 degrees Fahrenheit, it must first become completely desiccated. When you sear raw meat, about half of its stay in the skillet is spent just getting rid of excess moisture before browning can even begin to occur. You know that vigorous sizzling sound when a steak hits a pan? That's the sound of moisture evaporating and bubbling out from underneath the meat. A prime rib that has first been roasted, on the other hand, has had several hours in a hot oven, during which time the exterior has completely dried out, making searing much more efficient and thus giving all but the very exterior of the meat less chance of overcooking. Taking what I had learned from both the oven temperature testing and the searing testing into account, I knew what I had to do to fulfill all 3 commandments. My goal should be to cook the interior of the roast as slowly as possible, that is, at as low a temperature as my oven could maintain, then sear it as fast as possible, that is, at as high a heat as possible. But searing in a pan is not that practical for a roast bigger than a couple of ribs. so I needed a way to do this all in the oven. While some recipes simply have you pump up the oven temperature toward the end of cooking, this is suboptimal. An oven can take 20 or 30 minutes to go from its lowest temperature to its highest temperature setting, during which time, once again, the outer layers of beef are busy overcooking. But then I thought, 20 to 30 minutes is exactly how long a rib roast needs to rest anyhow. What if I were to first cook it at a low temperature, 200 degrees Fahrenheit or lower, then take it out of the oven and allow it to rest while I heated the oven to its highest temperature, 500 degrees to 550 degrees Fahrenheit, and pop it back in just long enough to achieve a crust? What I achieved was nothing less than prime rib perfection. Score, commandment 1, perfect crust? Check. Commandment 2, no gray zone? Check. Commandment 3, full-on juiciness? Check. A crisp brown crust, no gray overcooked meat, and a rosy pink from center to edges. But wait, there's more. The best part? I found that by using this two-stage method, I had a much larger window of time within which to serve the beef. Once I finished the initial low-temperature phase of cooking, as long as I kept the roast covered in foil, it would stay warm for over an hour. All I had to do was pop it into the 550-degree Fahrenheit oven for 8 minutes, and the roast would emerge hot, sizzling, and ready to carve. No need to rest it, since the only part that was affected here was the very exterior. Family gatherings will never be the same. Now, if only I could find a way to expose the rosy center under my sister's crusty exterior, we'd really have something to celebrate at the holidays. What about jus? There's just one last question when it comes to prime rib. What about a great sauce to go with it? Most recipes will call for a pan sauce of some sort, making use of the drippings that collect in the bottom of the roasting pan as the beef cooks. But here's the thing. My technique is specifically designed to produce no drippings whatsoever. That is, all of that moisture and flavor stays inside the beef where it belongs. Truth be told, because of that fact, you really don't need any sauce at all. But some folks, traditionalists let's call them, absolutely need a sauce with their meat. So, how do we get it? The easiest solution I've found is to use some extra beef. By searing off a few hunks of oxtails in a Dutch oven, deglazing the drippings with wine and stock, adding some vegetables, and then roasting the whole lot in the oven with the prime rib, you can build a powerfully flavored jus, with the added benefit of having a pile of fall-off-the-bone tender braised oxtails to serve alongside the roast. The Food Lab's Complete Guide to Buying, Storing, and Cooking Lamb. I think lamb is delicious, and so do many cultures. But in most of the United States, it's a different story. The average U.S. per capita consumption of a few different types of meat graph is located in the bonus PDF. That's right. We eat more than 100 pounds of chicken per year each, but we eat only 0.8 pound lamb per year, and the amount is getting smaller every year. In the 1970s, it was a larger but still woefully tiny 3 pounds per year. Not only that, but the vast majority of Americans don't eat a single bite of lamb all year. Most of this per capita consumption comes from minority communities, Greek, Muslim, Indian, who eat a ton of it, bringing up the overall average. Even more distressing is the fact that lamb is what economists call an inferior good, which means that its demand is inversely proportional to average consumer income. When people have money to spend, they'd rather spend it on beef and chicken breasts. A 2001 study from Kennesaw State University in Georgia found that for every 1% increase in consumer income, there was a corresponding 0.54% decrease in lamb consumption. It's an odd dichotomy, because while in many communities, lamb is seen as the cheap meat, the meat to buy when you can't afford beef, in high-end food and fancy supermarket circles, It's often far more expensive and desirable than beef. I'm with the latter camp. I can think of precious few situations when I'd rather have a steak than a fatty, musky lamb chop, or when I'd rather have a pot roast than a rich, slightly funky braised lamb shank. And when it comes to holiday roasts, prime rib may be the king of the table, but roasted leg of lamb is his wilder, more fun cousin. Lamb marketers who have long known of the trouble with selling their product to consumers reluctant to leave the safety of their beloved chicken and beef have responded by carefully breeding and raising lamb that is more suitable for the American palate, as well as selling it in forms that are increasingly easier to cook. Indeed, if you haven't attempted to cook lamb for yourself at home yet, you really have no excuse. What better time to start than now? Domestic versus imported. I see lamb from Australia, New Zealand, and the United States at the butcher. What are the differences between these options? And is one better than another? There are major differences in terms of flavor, size, and price when it comes to American lamb versus lamb from down under. New Zealand, Australian lambs are quite small in size, with whole legs coming in at around 5 to 6 pounds. According to Mark Pastor, president of Pat LaFrieda, one of the most respected meat purveyors in the country, their size is a matter of both genetics and feed. The lambs are smaller to begin with, and they spend their lives grazing on grass. Grass gives them a more gamey flavor, which some people find off-putting, and they also tend to be lower in fat, making them a bit harder to cook properly. The legs, in particular, have a tendency to dry out. That said, if you're cooking for a smaller party, 6 to 8 people or so, and you value that gamey flavor over tenderness or richness, New Zealand or Aussie lamb is a good choice. American lambs are larger, fattier, and sweeter in flavor. Most American lambs are fed on grass for most of their lives, supplemented with grain for the last 30 days before slaughter. The lamb at LaFrieda comes from Mennonite farms in Colorado that finish their lambs on a combination of grain, honey, alfalfa, wheat, and flaked corn. The results are a larger layer of protective fat around the legs and better marbling, the intramuscular fat that adds flavor and moistness to meat. Because of the grain supplements, American lamb tends to have a less funky but richer flavor, more similar to steak. A single leg of American lamb can weigh up to 15 pounds or so, with enough meat to feed over a dozen. I've read that grass-fed meat is always better. Better tasting, better for the animal. Is there any truth in this? It depends. Some people prefer the gamier taste of 100% grass-fed lamb. Others prefer the richer flavor and juicier meat of grain-finished lamb. As far as the health of the animal goes, while it's true that an animal that lived solely on grain would eventually develop health problems, much like a human who existed solely on hamburgers, grain finishing only occurs over the last 30 days of a lamb's life, after which it's going to be slaughtered anyway. That time period is not nearly long enough for the animal to develop any health problems that would cause it to suffer in any way. If you have no problem eating meat, you should have no problem eating grain-finished lamb or beef. What about the price differences? Unfortunately, American lamb tends to be more expensive than the imports, despite their long journey across the globe. It's a matter of scale. Australia and New Zealand's lamb output is several times greater than that of the United States. If you value tenderness and juiciness, the extra cost is probably worth it. Bones. I'm confused by all of the butchering options I have when buying a lamb leg. What should I be looking for? Bone-in leg of lamb comes in two forms, shank end and sirloin end. Occasionally, you'll find a massive one for sale with both the shank and sirloin. Shank end legs start at just above the lamb's ankle and go to midway up the calf bone, while sirloin end legs start at the hip and stop at around the knee. I prefer the sirloin end because the meat is fattier and more tender, and the cut is more evenly shaped, making it easier to cook. On the other hand, the shank end tends to have slightly more flavorful meat. and its tapering shape is actually desirable for cooks who like being able to offer both medium-rare meat from the thick upper part and well-done meat from the thin lower part. There are advantages to buying a bone-in lamb leg. It's generally cheaper per pound, even accounting for the weight of the bone. The bone can act as an insulator, making the whole thing cook more slowly and giving you a certain leeway in terms of hitting that medium-rare sweet spot. Contrary to what some believe, the bone does not actually add much flavor to the meat, though the meat directly around it will be a tad bit more tender due to the fact that it will be less cooked. But boned lamb leg also offers advantages. First of all, it's lighter, making the arduous task of lifting it in and out of the oven much easier on the back. It's also easier to calculate how much you need to feed your party. Finally, and this is probably the greatest advantage of all, it's far easier to carve. Just cut straight through it into neat, even slices. Butterflied leg of lamb is a boneless leg that has been split open and then opened out. This is how I prefer to purchase my lamb. It affords me the opportunity to season it both inside and out. Often, this just means a quick rub with salt and pepper before rolling it up and tying it, but it can also mean more elaborate rubs or herb mixtures. What about rack of lamb? Rack of lamb is the lamb equivalent of a prime rib of beef. It's that same muscle and same set of rib bones. The only difference is that a lamb is much smaller than a steer, hence the daintier proportions. And while beef rib bones are generally cut to within a few inches of the eye of meat, lamb rib bones are left longer, which makes for a stunning presentation, as well as giving you a convenient handle with which to hold your chops if you choose to eat caveman style, gnawing the juiciest chunks of meat and fat off the bones at the end. When it comes to buying racks, you've got two basic options, as-is or Frenched. Frenched is just a fancy way of saying, we strip the meat from the ends of the ribs for you so they look all nice and pretty. Because it looks so nice, most lamb racks do come Frenched. But to be honest, I prefer unfrenched racks because the juicy, fatty rib meat clinging to the bones is some of the tastiest stuff on the animal. Think of it as lamb bacon. Seasoning, rolling, and tying. What are some good things to season my lamb with? Salt is a must. And just as with steak or a beef roast, the best time to salt your lamb is either the day before roasting or immediately before cooking. If you've got the time, season the lamb and letting it rest uncovered on a rack in a rimmed baking sheet in the fridge will season it more deeply as well as dry out its exterior, allowing for superior browning. With its robust flavor, lamb takes well to all kinds of spice mixes and aromatics. With a butterflied leg, you want to apply your seasoning to both the inner and outer surfaces before rolling it up. Here are a few of my favorite combinations. Lots of garlic, rosemary, and anchovies. Olives and parsley. Ground cumin and fennel. Harissa and garlic. Why do I need to tie up my butterflied lamb leg? If you don't tie up a butterflied leg, it won't keep a regular shape during cooking. An irregular shape leads to uneven cooking. Uneven cooking leads to unhappy bellies. Unhappy bellies lead to a lack of familial harmony. And lack of familial harmony leads to ruined holidays. Would you risk ruining a holiday for 5 minutes of work and the cost of a roll of butcher's twine? Okay, I'm convinced. How do I do it? Simple. After laying your lamb out flat and seasoning it, roll it up again with the fat on the exterior, then lay it seam side down over pieces of butcher's twine that you've already thoughtfully laid out in parallel lines on the cutting board at 1-inch intervals, each piece long enough to tie easily around the roast. Working from the ends toward the center, tie up the lamb. It's the same process as tying up a beef tenderloin. Your lamb is now ready to cook. Cooking in the oven. How do I know when my lamb is done? Can I just follow one of those handy timetables with X minutes per pound? Absolutely not. Ignore any and every timing chart you've ever seen. They don't work because they don't take into account basic things like variances in shape and fat content, both of which can drastically affect how fast your meat cooks. Instead, get yourself a good digital instant read thermometer. Do I sound like a broken record here? Just do it! Doneness levels for lamb are pretty much the same as for beef, and they are the same whether you are talking leg or rack. 120 degrees Fahrenheit, rare. Bright red and slippery inside. The abundant intramuscular fat has yet to soften and render. 130 degrees Fahrenheit, medium rare. The meat has begun to turn pink and is significantly firmer, juicier, moister, and more tender than either rare or medium meat. 140 degrees Fahrenheit, medium. Solid rosy pink and quite firm to the touch. Still moist, but verging on dry. The fat is fully rendered at this stage, delivering plenty of flavor. 150 degrees Fahrenheit, medium well. Pink, but verging on gray. The moisture level has dropped precipitously, and the texture is chewy and fibrous. The fat has fully rendered and begun to collect outside the roast, carrying away flavor with it. 160 degrees Fahrenheit, well done. Dry, gray, and lifeless. The moisture loss is up to 18%, and the fat is completely rendered. Just like with beef, I personally recommend cooking lamb to at least medium rare. It's hot enough that the abundant fat in the meat has begun to melt, lubricating and flavoring the meat. Rare lamb is tougher and less flavorful. So, if I'm cooking it in the oven, what temperature should I use? Just as with cooking any large piece of meat, you've got a decision to make right off the bat. Do you want to cook hot or cool? Cooking in a high oven will obviously get dinner on the table much faster, but it'll also result in far more uneven cooking, with the outer layers of the meat overcooking and turning gray by the time the center is done. Now, I understand that some people don't mind this. I like having some juicy medium-rare meat and some tougher well-done meat on my plate, they say. Those of you who feel this way should be thankful. It makes cooking roasts very easy. Just bang it into a hot oven, around 400 degrees Fahrenheit should do, and roast until the very center reaches the desired temperature. But if you, like me, want your lamb evenly cooked from edges to center, the best thing to do is slow roast it, just as when cooking prime rib. Place it in a 200 degree Fahrenheit oven until it is within a few degrees of your desired serving temperature. Use that thermometer. Remove it, crank the oven up as far as it will go, and let it heat up. Then throw the lamb back in for about 15 minutes to crisp up the well-rendered fat layer on the exterior. Do I have to let my lamb rest just like beef? Just as with a steak or a beef roast, lamb muscles tighten when they're hot. As they loosen up during resting, their ability to retain their juices increases. This means that more juice ends up in your meat and less on the cutting board. Allow lamb roasted entirely at a high temperature to rest for at least 20 minutes after removing it from the oven, and meat roasted low and slow to rest for at least 10 minutes. Carving a bone-in leg of lamb. When you've got a bone-in leg of lamb, you'll notice that the bone runs along one side of the bulk of the meat. You want to slice from the opposite side. Using a fork or tongs to hold the lamb steady, use a long, thin carving knife to cut the meat into thin slices. Some of these slices may remain attached to the bone, but that's okay. Separate them by then making a single slice across the top and side of the bone. The slices should fall away neatly for you to serve. Cooking rack of lamb. Though a rack of lamb is technically a roast, it's actually much more useful to think of it as if it were a steak, which makes sense because the proportions are about the same, a couple inches thick at most, as is the composition, tender meat with a good amount of intramuscular fat. So, when I cook a rack of lamb, unless I'm doing something fancy and involved like beer coolers sous vide, I do it pretty much the same way I cook my butter-basted steak. Skip the oven completely and roast it in a moderately hot pan on the stovetop. The same basic rules apply. 1. Dry the rack and season it liberally either at least 45 minutes before cooking or immediately before cooking. 2. Don't bother letting it come to room temperature if cooking it immediately. It'll cook about the same either way. 3. Use the heaviest pan you've got for more even heat distribution and a better sear. 4. Manage your temperature so that the lamb is perfectly browned just when the center hits medium rare. 5. Don't crowd the pan. A couple of racks in a 12-inch skillet is about the most you can do at once. 6. Flip as often as you'd like. This leads to faster, more even cooking. 7. Don't add butter until close to the end or it'll burn. 8. Make sure to brown the edges of the racks. 9. Let the meat rest before carving and serving. The only other issue with a rack of lamb is its somewhat awkward shape. Because of the curvature of the bones, it's basically impossible to get good contact with the skillet on the inside curve of the bones. The solution is to simply not bother trying. Rather than letting the inside curve of the bones cook via the heat of the pan, it's better to cook them by basting them with hot fat. Rack of lamb is expensive, which may have turned you away from cooking it in the past. But trust me, with this method and a good thermometer at your side, it's nearly impossible to mess it up, and you will enjoy the results. Ultra Crisp Roast Pork Shoulder. Pork shoulder is the lead of culinary alchemists, just waiting, itching to be turned into gold. We're talking pork butt, in all of its juicy, porky, spoon tender in the middle, impossibly crisp and crusty on the outside glory. The transformation of one of the cheapest cuts of meat in the butcher's display case into one of the most glorious, festive centerpieces imaginable is nothing short of a miracle. At least, it would be if we believed in such things. But we're here for the science of it, right? What makes pork get tender? How do we maximize that tenderness? And above all, how do we get the crisp, crackling skin that everyone fights over? A full bone-in Boston butt is a formidable piece of meat, usually weighing in at around 8 to 12 pounds, riddled with a significant amount of connective tissue and intramuscular fat, all swathed in a thick, tough skin. Our goal is to make this tough piece of meat spoonably tender. How do you do that? Well, first, we need to understand the difference between the two major types of muscles in an animal. Fast twitch muscle is the stuff that the animal rarely uses, except in short bursts. The breasts on a chicken that let it flap its wings rapidly when escaping danger. The loins on a cow that, well, barely get used at all. Fast twitch muscle is characterized by tenderness. Think chicken breast, pork chops, and New York strip steaks. And a fine textured grain, and is best prepared using fast cooking methods like roasting, grilling, or sautéing. With fast twitch muscle, optimal eating conditions are met pretty much as soon as you reach your final serving temperature, say 145 degrees Fahrenheit for a chicken breast or 125 degrees Fahrenheit for a steak. As the meat is heated, it contracts, squeezing out moisture at a rate that's proportional to the temperature it's raised to. So, for example, you know that as soon as a steak hits 150 degrees Fahrenheit, its muscle fibers have contracted enough to squeeze out about 12% of its moisture, and there's no turning back. Slow twitch muscle, on the other hand, comprises the continually working muscles in an animal, the shoulders and haunches that keep the animal upright and walking, the tail muscles that keep the flies off, the muscles around the flank that keep the animal breathing. Slow twitch muscle is characterized by robust flavor and a very tough texture with lots of connective tissue that needs to be cooked for an extended period of time to break it down. With slow twitch muscle, the tenderness of the finished product is dependent not only on the temperature at which it's cooked, but also on the length of time it is cooked. Beginning at around 160 degrees Fahrenheit, the tough connective tissue, collagen, begins to break down into tender, juicy gelatin. The hotter the meat, the faster this breakdown occurs. To put it simply, with fast twitch muscle, temperature is the most important factor when cooking. With slow twitch, both time and temperature affect the final product. Whether we're talking pork shoulder, pot roast, braised turkey legs, or any other meat, the temperature ranges at which moisture expulsion and connective tissue breakdown take place are nearly identical. But exactly how long does it take collagen to break down into gelatin at a given temperature? I decided to find out. Using a vacuum sealer and a temperature-controlled water bath, I cooked cubes of pork shoulder at 160 degrees, 175 degrees, 190 degrees, and 205 degrees Fahrenheit, keeping track of exactly how long it took to fully tenderize the meat at each temperature, and found that the amount of time needed to tenderize a piece of meat increases exponentially as the temperature is lowered. At 205 degrees Fahrenheit, nearly as hot as a piece of meat can get, the cooking time was a mere 3 hours, while at 160 degrees Fahrenheit, it took a full day and a half. If higher temperatures lead to faster breakdown of connective tissue, shouldn't you just blast your pork shoulder at the highest oven temperature it can take without burning the skin? Not so fast. Temperature has other effects too, namely drying meat out. I roasted two identical pork shoulders until they were both equally tender, one at 375 degrees Fahrenheit, which took about 3 hours, and the second at 250 degrees Fahrenheit, which took about 8 hours. After roasting, I calculated the amount of total moisture lost by the meat by adding together the weight of the finished roast and the fatty drippings in the pan below and subtracting that from the initial weight of the roast. Turns out that at a higher temperature, a pork shoulder loses about 8% more juices than at a lower temperature due to the muscle fibers contracting and squeezing out their contents. Eating the meat from the two roasts confirmed as much, though, to be honest, both were pretty crazy juicy and moist. But the high-temperature roast showed at least one definite advantage over the low roast, the skin. In the hotter roast, the skin turned out crisp and crunchy, although not amazingly so, while in the low-temperature roast, the skin softened but was floppy and flaccid, a total bust. So is there a way to get juicier meat and crisp skin? The problem is that cooking a great piece of pork skin requires two different approaches. Skin job. There's a common misconception that animal skin, chicken skin, turkey skin, pork rinds, is made up entirely of fat. This is not true. There certainly is a lot of fat in the skin and directly underneath it, necessary to help warm-blooded animals maintain their body temperature, but skin also contains a great deal of water and connective proteins that, just like the connective tissues and slow-twitch muscles, must be broken down via long cooking. On top of that, once the connective tissue has softened sufficiently, moisture must be forced out of it and the remaining proteins heated until they coagulate and stiffen up. It's the combination of these three things, connective tissue breakdown, moisture loss, and firming of proteins, that leads to crisp but not tough skin. When a pork shoulder is cooked at 375 degrees Fahrenheit, all three of these things happen at about the same time. By the time the connective tissue has broken down, you've driven off enough moisture from the rind to render it hard and crunchy. In a 250 degree Fahrenheit oven, connective tissue breaks down for sure, but moisture loss and protein stiffening don't occur to a great enough degree to deliver a crisp finished product. So clearly, once again, we should be cooking our pork at a higher temperature, right? But hold on, dear. We got one more thing to consider. Patience. Bubble, bubble. We all know what surface area is, right? Take a look at a close-up of a piece of the crisp skin from the pork cooked at 375 degrees Fahrenheit, located in the bonus PDF. See how, despite a few wrinkles here and there, it's relatively smooth? Well, smooth objects have relatively low surface area given a particular volume, while wrinkled, bubbled, crinkly, curvy objects have a relatively high surface area given the same volume. And when it comes to texture, more surface area equals more crunch. It's the same principle behind, say, scratching up the surface of potatoes before roasting them to get them extra crisp, or packing your burger extra loose to give it a crisper exterior and more browning. When roasting at 375 degrees Fahrenheit, because the dehydrating and protein setting is taking place at the same time that the connective tissue is breaking down, there's never really a stage when the skin is relatively soft. It goes from being firm because of the connective tissue directly to being firm through dehydration. On the other hand, after 8 hours in a 250 degree Fahrenheit oven, the skin has very little structural integrity. It's stretchy, soft, and easily bent. Indeed, if you looked at it under a microscope, you'd find that the structure of the skin very much resembled a whole bunch of interconnected balloons just waiting to be filled. How do you fill those balloons? Let heat do the work for you. If you take that slow-cooked pork and bang it into a preheated 500 degree Fahrenheit oven, air and steam trapped within the skin will rapidly expand, causing millions of tiny bubbles to form. And here's the key. As the bubbles expand, their walls stretch out thinner and thinner. Eventually, they are so thin that the heat from the oven is able to quite rapidly set them into a permanent shape that won't collapse even when the pork is pulled out of the oven. In this sense, pig skin is very much like raw pizza dough going into a hot oven. The high temperature causes gas expansion, which then gets trapped in a protein matrix that firms up in the heat of the oven to create a crunchy, crisp crust. I generally prefer my meat relatively unadorned. Good meat, salt, and pepper is all I need. Pork shoulder, on the other hand, is great at taking on flavor. Feel free to rub the meat and skin with your favorite spice blend or dry rub before roasting it, or, my method of choice, since it keeps your options open, keep it plain for roasting and then season the shredded tender meat before serving. Actually, I like to bring the whole thing to the table and allow diners to pick and pull at it with their fingers, offering a few sauces to work with on the side. Try sweet and spicy nuoc cham, Chinese-style char siu, Cuban mojo, or a bright Argentinian chimichurri. Or, better yet, since this is a pork party, throw out a whole selection. Shredded roasted pork shoulder is excellent on its own, even better in sandwiches with a bit of coleslaw, and it makes an excellent addition to soups, stews, taco fillings, Cuban sandwiches, empanada fillings, arepa stuffings, hash, omelets, etc. It's nearly as difficult to mess up slow-cooked pork shoulder as it is to bring the sucker to the table without eating half the skin yourself before it arrives. No buts about it. You may have seen large cuts of pork in the supermarket labeled pork butt, but a few ninth grade classes in physiology would have told you that what you were looking at was not a butt, but a shoulder. What's up with the odd labeling? Pork shoulder and pork butt are the same cut of meat, and it's an oddity of nomenclature, not anatomy, that makes them so. Turns out that in the early 19th century, New England was a pork production powerhouse. The loins, bellies, and hams were eagerly snatched up by native New Englanders. But the far less desirable shoulder cut, obviously, the Yanks didn't know jack about BBQ, some argue they still don't, was packed into wooden barrels and shipped out across the country. The barrels came in different sizes, but the ones pork was packed into were of the size officially known as butt or pipe. That'd be a 126-gallon barrel, half the size of a 252-gallon tun, larger than an 84-gallon firkin, and twice the size of a 63-gallon hogshead, which, incidentally, has nothing to do with actual hogs or heads. The pork-filled, butt-sized barrels shipped out across the country came to be known as Boston butts, a term that was soon applied to the meat inside, despite the fact that it actually came from the shoulder of the hog. To this day, the term is widely used. Depending on what part of the country you come from, you'll see pork shoulders labeled shoulder, butt, Boston butt, or blade roast, while the lower part of the front is sold as picnic shoulder. Ironically, you'll never see pork shoulder labeled Boston butt in Boston itself. Had our forebears designed to ship pork in 10-gallon barrels, we might have found ourselves spooning slow-cooked pulled Boston firkin into our BBQ sandwiches, or perhaps making our Italian sausages out of Boston puncheon from 84-gallon barrels. Or, if those shoulders were shipped to New Mexico in 18-gallon barrels, they'd be chowing down on chili verde made with Boston rundlet. So then the question is, what do they call the anatomical butt of the pig? That'd be the ham. Crown roast of pork. So it's holiday time again, and your little sister has adopted a pet calf, so beef's off the menu. Your mother can't stand the aroma of lamb, and everybody's sick of turkey. What to do? Enter the crown roast of pork. Pretty, presentable, and delicious, it's the best pork option for those who prefer their pork a little leaner than, say, an all-belly porchetta, and who like it with a distinct chew and texture of a good meaty roast. What is a crown roast? A crown roast is nothing more than one or two regular bone-in pork loin roasts, that's the big muscle that runs down the back of the pig, formed into a circle with the ribs pointed skyward. Essentially, it's a long rack of pork chops joined together, or more accurately, that have never been cut apart, and twisted into a crown shape. Ah, I got it. The same way that a prime rib of beef is like a bunch of ribeye steaks left connected to each other, right? Exactly. And what's the point? Does it make cooking easier? Does it taste better in the end? The crown in a crown roast serves about as much purpose as the crown on a king. It's mostly aesthetic. A crown roast simply looks stunning when presented at the table. But it does aid in even cooking to a small degree. With the bones twisted so that they are all on the exterior of the roast, heat transfer to the meat is slowed, making for juicier, more evenly cooked meat in the end, though the trade-off is that the fatty cover around the meat will never get quite as crisp and browned as it would if you were to roast a whole rack of pork without forming it into a crown. So it's a bit of give and take. Say I want to go for it. How do I go about finding a crown? To form a crown with a single rack of ribs, about 10 ribs, enough to feed 6 to 8 normal appetited people, you need to score the spaces in between the ribs slightly so that they splay out. However, by doing this, you end up increasing the surface area of the pork, which can cause it to dry out more than it would if it were completely intact, and I don't recommend buying single-rack crown roasts for this reason. Better to buy a crown roast formed by 2 bone-in loins attached end-to-end, which are large enough to form a circle without unnecessary scoring. When purchasing a crown roast, you will usually have to ask your butcher to form it for you. Only very dedicated butchers are likely to have them formed and ready to go. You may have luck finding a ready-to-roast crown at a high-end supermarket, particularly around the holidays. How big a roast will I need? Aim for about a rib and a half per person, or 2 per person if you're big eaters and looking for leftovers. I've got my crown roast home, and boy, was that heavy. Now, how the heck do I cook this thing? Well, remember, a crown roast is nothing more than a series of connected pork chops, fast twitch muscle. Like all fast twitch muscles, say chicken breast, New York strip steak, or tuna loin, it has plenty of fine textured muscle and not much connective tissue or fat. This means that internal temperature is the most important factor when it comes to cooking it. With little to no connective tissue to break down, as soon as it reaches its final temperature, it's done. Holding it at that temperature for an extended period of time will change it very little. The key is to get the entire roast from edges to center to around 140 degrees Fahrenheit, medium, which is what I like my pork cooked to, while simultaneously crisping the exterior. Luckily, we've already studied this very same engineering problem applied to prime rib. Remember, the hotter your oven temperature, the more uneven your roasting will be. So, for example, if you cook a crown roast in a 400 degree Fahrenheit oven, by the time the very center is at 140 degrees Fahrenheit, the outer layers of the meat are well past the 165 degrees to 180 degrees Fahrenheit mark. Roast it in a 250 degree Fahrenheit oven, and you can get the entire thing pretty much exactly at 140 degrees Fahrenheit from edges to center. Then all it takes after roasting is a rest and a quick bang into a 500 degree Fahrenheit oven to crisp up the fat on the exterior. Neat! And what about flavoring? If you want to be all fancy pants about it, you can add other seasonings to the exterior in addition to the kosher salt and black pepper I opt for. Herbs stuffed into the center would be nice, as would be garlic, shallots, citrus fruit, whatever tickles your fancy pants. Some folks even like to fill the center with sausage or bread-based stuffing. It's a fine thing to do if you have tons of guests to feed, and a solid stuffing like that will actually improve the cooking qualities of the pork, as it acts as an insulating barrier to heat. Do note, though, that it will dramatically increase cooking time. Count on up to an hour more. Or, better yet, count on your thermometer. I'm the kind of person who likes to wear a hat just to go pick up the mail. What would you suggest for someone like me? Go ahead and put cute little paper hats over the ends of the bones before serving to cover up the charring they will get. Or, if you prefer, use foil hats while they cook to prevent them from charring. You can buy those paper hats online very cheaply. Personally, I like the primal nature of the way charred ribs look, enough so that I had my wife's engagement ring delivered to her on the bone of a wild boar chop. Isn't that romantic? Glazed pork tenderloin. One skillet meals are a real lifesaver on busy weekday nights, or on weekends when you just want to spend that extra half hour playing with the dog instead of washing pots and pans. These pork tenderloin recipes feed a group of six, take about half an hour to prepare, and require nothing more than a skillet and a couple of mixing bowls. It's tough to cook tenderloin medallions properly. Tenderloin is a lean cut, which means that heat travels through it rapidly, and it can go from being moist and juicy to dry and stringy with little warning. Because I'm the kind of guy who likes to hedge his bets and give himself the best odds possible, I never slice my pork tenderloin into medallions before cooking it. It's a surefire road to overcooked pork, which, if you've ever had it, tastes like broken dreams and unicorn tears. Not fun. It's far more foolproof to cook your tenderloin whole, slicing it only when you serve it. With an ultra-tender and very thin cut like this, slow roasting, followed by a blast in the oven, is not an option. Even the quickest of blasts would be enough to overcook it internally. Instead, we have to opt for a more efficient browning method, searing in a skillet, then finishing it in a hot oven. In order to maximize browning even more, I dredge the tenderloins in cornstarch. Cornstarch itself browns reasonably well, but, even more important, it absorbs excess moisture from the surface of the meat, allowing it to cook more efficiently. As it happens, cornstarch also creates the perfect surface for a tasty glaze to stick to. Think of it like coating your car with primer before you apply the paint. I treat these glazes as something in between a glaze and a pan sauce. After browning the pork in the skillet, I pour in my glaze ingredients, using them to scrape up any browned bits from the bottom of the pan. These browned bits bring a ton of flavor, and when I then return the tenderloins to the skillet and finish them off in the oven, spooning the glaze over them, it puts that flavor right back on the surface of the pork where it belongs. Slow roasted porchetta. Does anyone else feel like porchetta, the Italian slow roasted, fennel scented, juicy pork surrounded with crisp, crackling skin, is appearing everywhere these days? Not that I'm complaining. As far as I'm concerned, the more slow cooked pork in my life, the better. Indeed, my goal is to get a porchetta on every table in America this year, and perhaps some beyond our borders as well. I'm counting on you all to help me achieve my vision of a United States of porkdom. Here are a few reasons why you should consider topping your dinner table with a porchetta roast. It's delicious. It's easily more delicious than turkey, pretty much definitely more delicious than prime rib, and arguably better than a leg of lamb. It looks awesome. Other roasts can be imposing in the center of the table, but none are as geometrically perfect, as easy to carve, and as breathtakingly covered in crackly skin. Because I'm the husband of a well-proportioned mathematician, geometric symmetry is something I think about quite often and find aesthetically pleasing. In this case, it makes for easy, even cooking. No awkward thin regions that overcook or thick regions that stay raw in the center. It helps avoid fights. Holidays can be a bit trying for the whole family, especially when you're fighting over dark meat or light meat or who gets to gnaw on the rib bones. With porchetta, every single slice is exactly the same, by which I mean perfect. It's forgiving. Accidentally overcook red meat or poultry, and it'll be so dry you might as well serve the gravy-soaked contents of your paper recycling bin to your guests. Overcook porchetta and... Wait, that's right. You pretty much can't overcook porchetta. Leave it in the oven for an extra hour or two? No worries, it'll still taste fantastic. It's inexpensive. Pork belly might cost you about $10 per pound at a fancy butcher. More likely, you'll find it for $4 to $5 a pound, at least a quarter the cost of a well-marbled prime rib. Want to serve aged prime rib? You must have some deep, deep pockets. Leftover porchetta sandwiches are freaking awesome. That's all there is to say about that one. Not convinced yet? Listen on, my friend. What is porchetta? Traditional porchetta is made by butchering a hog so that the boned-out loin is still attached to the boned-out belly. The meat is then carefully salted and rubbed with a garlic, herb, and spice mixture that features plenty of fennel and black pepper, along with ingredients like crushed red pepper, citrus zest, and rosemary, sage, and other piney-scented herbs. You can, of course, vary the mixture to suit your own tastes. By carefully rolling the two cuts up together, you end up with a single, perfectly cylindrical roast with the fatty belly surrounding the lean loin, all covered in a layer of skin. As the rolled porchetta rests, the salt slowly penetrates into the meat, dissolving the muscle protein myosin and altering its structure so that it's able to retain moisture more effectively, as well as giving it a slight bouncier, more resilient texture. Think sausage or ham, not rubber ball. When the pork is subsequently roasted, the fatty belly portion, rich in juices and connective tissues, ostensibly helps keep the relatively dry loin moist. But we all know that this isn't really how cooking works. All the fat in the world surrounding a lean, tightly textured muscle like a pork loin will not help keep it moist if you cook it past 150 degrees Fahrenheit or so, and indeed, many porchettas I've had have had some unconscionably dry centers because of this. But belly, with its extensive network of connective tissue and abundant fat content, needs to be cooked to at least 160 degrees Fahrenheit for a couple of hours in order for that tissue to slowly break down and for some of the fat to render. Loin needs to stay below 150 degrees Fahrenheit. Belly needs to get above 160 degrees Fahrenheit. You can see the problem here. So why do traditional porchetta recipes call for both belly and loin? My guess is that at the time porchetta was invented, hogs hadn't yet been bred to have large, lean loins, and thus there wasn't as big a distinction between the belly and the loin sections. Both would have had plenty of fat and connective tissue, making both totally tasty even when cooked to a higher temperature. Today, we need a better solution. And here's one. Discard the loin and go for an all-belly porchetta instead. We all know that pork belly, the cut that the magnificence that is bacon comes from, is the king of pork cuts, and that pork is the king of meats, and that meats are the masters of the universe. This makes eating an all-belly porchetta somewhat akin to consuming an aromatic, crispy, salty slab of awesome seasoned with He-Man, or something like that. You get the picture. Tracking down an intact single belly shouldn't actually be too difficult. What you want is a whole, boneless, rind-on belly with the rib meat still attached. It should weigh in at around 12 to 15 pounds or so. Your butcher should be able to order one for you, or if you live near a Chinatown, take a stroll into one of the butcher shops there. Most likely, they've got pork bellies in stock. Once you've got your belly, everything else is a piece of cake. Just give yourself enough time to execute. Assembling the porchetta itself should take no more than an hour, and once it's assembled, you can wrap it in plastic and store it in the fridge for up to 3 days, so long as the belly was quite fresh when you got it. It'll actually improve with age as the salt works its way through the meat. 7. Tomato sauce, macaroni, and the science of pasta. My wife and Irving the doorman have got a pretty sweet deal. All they have to do is nothing, and they get hot, fresh food delivered to them several times a day. Of course, they do have to be content with eating, say, fried chicken and nothing else for a month as I test a recipe, but, all in all, they've pretty much got it made. So you can imagine my surprise one day when I walked into the kitchen and saw my wife cooking, and my even greater surprise when I realized she was cooking pasta in our smallest pot and at a simmer. The water barely covered the noodles as she stirred them to keep them submerged. "You can't do that," I exclaimed in horror. "Obviously, my diminutive wife, you haven't cooked a lot of pasta in your time. Unless you use a giant pot of water at a rolling boil, your pasta will stick together. The starch will become too concentrated. It will cook unevenly. It will become mushy. It will be 9 different sorts of horrible, each one worse than the one before. It is scientific fact that you will end up with an inedible, starchy, sticky blob." "Is that so?" was all she said as she turned back to the pot. Needless to say, my wife was right. The pasta was fine, though I declined to eat any more than a single tester piece, citing potential paradoxes in the space-time continuum as my reason. Indeed, she has precedence for her method. Even Harold McGee, in a New York Times article in 2009, has mentioned the small pot method of pasta cooking. So what gives? Exactly what is the best way to cook, sauce, and serve pasta? In this chapter, we'll get into all of that, along with discovering what I call the mother sauces of Italian-American cookery, the 5 simple sauces that form the base for countless variations: olive oil and garlic sauces, tomato sauces, pesto, cream sauces, and meat ragu. But first, what exactly is pasta? Pasta traditions. At its simplest, pasta is nothing more than flour and water mixed together to form a dough, cut into shapes, and cooked in boiling water. As a food that has been made in China since the 2nd century BC, in the Middle East since the 9th century, and Europe since at least the 11th, it has one of the longest and most drawn-out and downright confusing histories of any food around, though we can pretty safely say that Marco Polo did not play more than an apocryphal role in it. And that history is the realm of historians, not of cooks. So why do I bring it up now? Only to illustrate my naivete in telling my wife she was wrong for cooking it in a particular manner. In fact, you hear all sorts of things coming from folks who claim to be direct descendants of Signore Polo, or perhaps acquaintances with the Pope's personal pasta producer. "Always use fresh, not dried," or "don't add too much sauce," or "do not add oil to your water," or, my favorite, "add salt only after it comes to a boil," often claiming tradition as the reason for doing so. Well, guess what? You don't need to listen to any of them. Indeed, cooking pasta in a large amount of boiling salted water for a matter of minutes is a relatively modern method. Prior to that, recipes called for cooking pasta for hours instead of minutes. Indeed, according to McGee, the term al dente didn't appear until after World War I. How's that for tradition? Given its varied background, I say that you should cook pasta whichever way works best. Just don't tell your nonna if you have one. Most pasta these days comes in two basic forms, dried and fresh. Fresh pasta, made from wheat flour and eggs, is widely used in northern Italy. The eggs add richness and color and improve the texture of the pasta, allowing it to become both tender and bouncy as it cooks. It's made by forming a stiff dough out of the eggs and flour, then rolling that dough repeatedly between two roller plates, getting progressively thinner with each roll, before finally cutting it into the desired shape. Since making fresh pasta requires time and specialized equipment, we won't be dealing with it much in this book. Instead, we're going to focus on the dried version. Dried pasta, which originated in southern Italy, is generally made from durum flour and water. Durum is a high-protein flour that allows you to form a tough, malleable dough that holds its shape well. This is particularly important for the intricate folded and extruded shapes that dried pasta comes in. To form dried pasta into shapes, the stiff dough is pressed into a machine that forces it through metal dies that extrude it, then cut it into smaller lengths. The very best dried pastas have a distinct wheaty flavor, and, more important, a rough texture that allows them to absorb sauce more easily once cooked. Of the major supermarket brands available in the United States, I prefer Barilla brand. When possible, though, I shop at Italian markets that import high-quality, small-batch pasta from Italy. What's the difference? Many of the inexpensive mass-market brands use Teflon-coated dyes in order to speed up production. These dyes result in a smooth finish on the pasta. Traditional brass dyes are slower to extrude but produce a rougher texture. When shopping for dried pasta, compare the texture of the noodles and pick the brand with the roughest-looking finish. The best way to cook pasta. If we go by traditional wisdom, pasta should be cooked in a large volume of salted water and added to the pot only after the water has reached a rolling boil. What's the reasoning here? There are four reasons generally cited. Reason 1. A large volume of water has a higher thermal mass than a smaller one. Thus, when you drop pasta into it, it cools less and returns to a boil much faster. Reason 2. A large volume of water at a rolling boil helps move the pasta pieces around so they don't stick to each other. Reason 3. A small volume of water will become too starchy as the pasta cooks. This will make the pasta stickier when you drain it. Reason 4. It's the way Grandma did it. Let's break them down point by point and see if we can't make some sense of them. Reason 1. To test this, I brought 3 pots of water to a boil, one with 6 quarts of water, one with 3 quarts, and one with a mere quart and a half. After the water in each pot came to a boil, I added the pasta and waited for it to return to a boil. The 3 pots did so within seconds of each other. In fact, the pot with 3 quarts actually came back to a boil slightly faster than the one with 6 quarts, the exact opposite of what is supposed to happen. What gives? To solve this mystery, we have to think about what's going on inside a pot of boiling water, what its energy inputs and outputs are. Imagine we have 2 pots of water on identical burners. One pot holds 2 gallons of boiling water, and the other holds 2 quarts. The inputs are simple. The burner underneath each one is supplying a constant energy source. As long as the burners are set at high, the amount of energy they transfer to the pot water system is consistent. What about energy loss? Well, that's going on too. First, there's energy being lost to the outside environment in the form of heat from the sides of the pot and the surface of the water. This amount of energy loss is proportional to the surface area of the pot water system, as well as its temperature. Since the temperature is staying at a constant 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and the pots are, presumably, not changing size, that too is a constant. The other factor that contributes to energy loss is something called the heat of vaporization. That's the energy it takes to convert water into steam. Both pots of water are boiling, and the difference between energy in and energy out is compensated for by the energy used to boil that water. So, energy in, energy out. With me so far? Now, what happens when we add some room temperature pasta to the pots? The temperature of the water immediately drops. How much it drops is inversely proportional to its total volume. The more water you have to begin with, the smaller the temperature change. A pound of pasta added to the 2-gallon pot will cause it to drop by only a degree or two, while a pound of pasta added to the 2-quart pot will cause a temperature drop 4 times as great, since a gallon is 4 times as big as a quart. Aha! You must be thinking. So the reasoning is correct. Lower volume means a bigger drop in temperature, which means a longer time to get back to a boil. On the face of it, it seems logical. But the problem is that it takes more energy to raise the temperature of 2 gallons of water than it does to raise the temperature of 2 quarts. How much more? Exactly 4 times more, in fact. And since our small pot dropped in temperature precisely 4 times as much as our large pot, it means that both pots will come back up to their boiling point in the same amount of time. To make it simpler, think about this. If you heated your pasta to 212 degrees Fahrenheit before dropping it into the pot of boiling water, the water would not cool at all and thus never lose a boil, no matter what volume of water you started with. So, the only energy we really need to add to the system, regardless of the size of the pot, is the energy it takes to bring the pound of pasta up to 212 degrees Fahrenheit. And that, my friends, is a constant. So it's pasta la vista to reason one. Reason two, drop the pasta into the water and just leave it there, and it will indeed stick to itself. But you know what? It'll do that even in a really big pot with lots of boiling water. The problem is that excess starches on the pasta immediately start to hydrate and gel together. But if you rinse those starches off, dilute them, or allow them to cook enough that they begin to set, the problem completely disappears. So the key is to stir the pasta a few times during the critical first minute or two in order to rinse off excess starch and make sure the pieces aren't sticking together until the outer layers are fully cooked. After that, whether the pasta is swimming in a hot tub of water or just barely covered, absolutely no sticking occurs. Impossible, you cry? Try it out for yourself. That's goodbye to reason two.